From Montpelier, Vermont, this is Public Health Radio. On today's show, we're presenting an archive interview from last December with Marge Cohn and Marta Santiago. In that interview, we discussed the impact of the HIV epidemic on women and their children. That interview occurred on the 20th anniversary of the very first medical report of HIV cases, so it was a time when the entire HIV community was taking stock of the successes and the challenges that lay ahead. Later in today's show, in our opinion segment, we'll hear from Marie Clark, who will be discussing the impact of the debt burden in the developing world on the struggle against HIV. So stay tuned. This is Public Health Radio. I'm your host, Marvin Malik. The first two items in our news update both come from the November 21st issue of the New England Journal of Medicine, and both are reports on new vaccines to prevent sexually transmitted diseases. The first concerns a newly developed vaccine against a strain of human papillomavirus, commonly referred to as HPV, which is believed to be responsible for approximately 50% of all cervical cancer cases. The vaccine was found to be highly effective. Over a six-month period, researchers at the University of Washington administered three doses of the vaccine to 738 women between the ages of 16 and 23 who had no antibody evidence of previous infection. A similar number of women received a placebo. The researchers observed that study participants for approximately 1.5 years after vaccination, none of the women who received the vaccine developed persistent HPV-16 infection or cancerous growths during the study period, while 41 of the women who received the placebo developed persistent infections, and 9 of them also developed precancerous growths on their cervix. The researchers intend to continue to monitor the progress of the women in the study. Because HPV-16 is not responsible for all cases of cervical cancer, the study authors warn that the vaccine would not be effective at preventing cancers caused by other strains of the virus. They added that a vaccine that could protect women from all types of HPV would be an important step forward. In a second study, also published in the same issue, researchers from the University of Texas performed two studies on a vaccine against genital herpes among individuals who had no history of that disease. The vaccine was found to be ineffective in men. Among women, however, the vaccine was 74% effective. The demonstrated benefit came largely from women who had never suffered from either oral herpes or genital herpes. Women with antibodies against the strain of herpes that primarily affects the mouth achieved minimal benefit from the vaccine. That vaccine should be available in about 5 years. The studies found that both the vaccines against HPV-16 and the vaccine against genital herpes were quite safe. Only minor side effects were noted. The online news service of the Kaiser Foundation reports that the World Trade Organization members may not make an end-of-the-year deadline to craft a plan to allow developing nations access to patented drugs, including anti-HIV drugs. The poor nations represented at the Doha negotiations were pushing to amend international patent laws to allow low-cost copies of brand-name drugs to be used in poor countries which are facing health epidemics. But the European Union, Switzerland, and the U.S., all home to large pharmaceutical companies, were instead pushing for a much more restricted agreement. In November 2001, a World Trade Organization working group approved a declaration that states that developing nations can override patent protections and manufacture medicines still under patent protection during emergencies. However, WTO members have been unable to agree on exact terms since then. Harvey Bale, director of the International Drug Industries Trade Group, expressed concern about how patent protections might be lifted, but also said that the agreement would not help the poor countries because they were incapable of properly delivering the medicines to their citizens. ACT UP Paris, an advocacy group supporting HIV treatment, criticized both the United States and the European Union, calling the stalemate in negotiations intolerable, and accused the United States of backing off commitments made a year before. Faced with a large budget deficit, the state of Tennessee has altered its guidelines for Medicaid eligibility. As a consequence, over 50,000 Medicaid recipients were notified last week that they no longer qualify for Medicaid and will be dropped from the program. This brings the total number already dropped to 138,000. Over the next month, an additional 103,000 cases are being reviewed, and most of those will likely be dropped as well. The total that will ultimately lose Medicaid insurance coverage is expected to be around 225,000. The state has taken the position that anyone who fails to bring in financial information to verify eligibility will be dropped. A limited number of these individuals, those with major chronic illnesses, may be allowed to remain in the program if they can demonstrate that they are being denied private insurance coverage due to pre-existing conditions. But this is not expected to help very many beneficiaries. When welfare reform passed 5 years ago, only 32% of those who returned to the workforce got private health insurance. Those who have remained on Medicaid with or without welfare are much less likely to find the kind of job that provides health insurance. Consequently, all of the 225,000 or so who are dropped from the Medicaid program will likely find themselves with no form of health insurance. Given that Medicaid is a major expense in every state, it is likely that many more states will implement similar policies, with state budgets across the country facing huge deficits. The number of individuals across the country with no form of health insurance could therefore soar far above the current number of 41 million. A study in Pennsylvania found that the number of individuals who had been appropriately screened for various forms of cancer dropped last year for the first time. These included cancer of the breast, cervix, and colon. Those who carried out the study felt that the biggest reason for the decline in cancer screening was the increase in the number of uninsured individuals. In fact, the percentage of uninsured residents in Pennsylvania rose to its highest level in a decade last year. The Raleigh News and Observer carried an article early this month which examined the gradual change in the role of school nurses. For many families, the school nurse has become the key medical provider, and in many cases, the sole medical provider. Just in the last 2 years, the number of uninsured children in North Carolina has risen by 50,000 and will soon exceed 250,000. The article highlights the dilemma school nurses faced trying to handle children with asthma, diabetes, and other complicated medical illnesses who have no ability to access a doctor. Coming up next, we'll look at HIV and the struggles that women who are HIV infected face after 20 years of the HIV epidemic. Stay tuned. This is Public Health Radio. I'm your host, Marvin Malik. Today, we're presenting an archive interview from December last year with Marge Cohen, the director of the Women in HIV Research Program and founder of the Women's HIV Clinic, both at Cook County Hospital. Marta Santiago also joined us for that interview. She is a patient of Dr. Cohen's and continues to work at Cook County Hospital's HIV outreach program. The interview looks at the ups and downs of the struggle against HIV over the 20 years of the epidemic, with a special focus of the impact of the disease on HIV-infected women. Here's the interview. Marcia Santiago and Dr. March Cohn, welcome to Public Health Radio.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
An article appeared in a 1981 issue of CDC's Weekly Alert, presenting the first case reports of pneumocystis pneumonia in a group of previously healthy young people. It turned out that the cause of the immune system defects in these individuals was HIV virus, so they were the first HIV cases reported in the medical literature. Dr. Cohn, tell me about your experiences with HIV. When did you first begin to see HIV-infected patients?
We saw HIV-infected patients at Cook County Hospital, where I work as an internist, in the early 1980s. My personal involvement began in 1988. I was approached by a woman with HIV, and she said to me, I have HIV infection, and I know that you're interested in HIV care, and you think that you know a lot about women, and you're a feminist. If that's really true, you must realize that women with HIV have a lot of serious problems that are different from men with HIV. So therefore, we really should have our own clinic. Following her direction, we applied for some funding and got together a group of providers and began seeing patients in July of 1988. And we have been going quite strong since then. We do see about 1,400 women and children in this clinic. We began with 30 women and one child, but over the last, 13 years, we've grown very large.
Marta,
yes.
Tell me about your experience, your first experience with HIV. What led you to get tested?
Well, actually, it was the TV commercials that I felt were kind of like pointing at me, saying, if you've done this in your past, if you've done that in your past, it was all pointing to things that I had done previously, and that's what kind of took me in.
Did you ever regret getting tested, and how do you feel about the whole thing now?
Oh, no. That was finding out I was positive was the first step of very many other things that were positive in my life thereafter. You know, taking care of myself, learning about myself, meeting new people, you know, actually a new family for me, all the staff that I got to meet, you know, my primary care team. So, no, that was a good thing for me.
Since the year 2001 was the 20th year of the HIV epidemic, articles appeared in several medical journals reviewing the 20 years of the epidemic, and the articles recalled that for the first 15 years, just about everyone involved with HIV, the doctors and the patients, were pretty frustrated, and many patients were turning to unresearched or unapproved treatments. I'd like to ask both of you, do you recall your feelings during that period?
I certainly do. I don't remember being concerned that patients were turning to treatments that were unresearched. Rather, I recall that we could not provide patients with care that could help them. And we saw an enormous number of deaths. We saw people suffer so much. There were weeks in the early 90s, mid-90s, when we just had large numbers of deaths every single week, and we were attending many, many funerals. We were dealing with an unbelievable amount of loss that was affecting those that were still alive with the virus, who had known the people who had died. It was very much affecting providers who felt somewhat hopeless in terms of turning the tide of the disease. I never felt that. I mean, I learned so much from the people with HIV about how to handle kind of a really bad hand in terms of having a virus that no one expected to get, and then learning how to respond to the difficulties that the virus imposed upon people, dying younger than one thought, not being able to see their children grow up. That loss was just extremely overwhelming for providers and for other participants. Very glad that there's been an enormous change in our feeling about that right now and the reality of people's lives with HIV, that it's changed so tremendously?
Well, I certainly feel very lucky that nothing really evolved with my virus, that it didn't go into something, you know, more drastic of any opportunistic infections. And it left me feeling, you know, well, why am I so different when I see all these other women that I knew, and, you know, they're all gone. Mm-hmm. And there's very few that I know from way back, the early 90s, late 80s. So it got me to thinking a lot, you know, well, why is it that I've got this lucky streak and the others don't?
What we now call highly active antiretroviral therapy was developed and came into clinical use sometime in the mid-1990s. How did you see this impact your practice, Dr. Cohen?
Oh, tremendously. I mean, we began to see people kind of reverse their course. People who were literally on death's door, many of those people had tremendous recoveries, total reversals of their clinical picture. People who had prepared for death, whose families prepared for death, whose partners prepared for their death, didn't die. And they gained weight, they felt healthier, some of them returned to work, some of them returned to school, some of them felt like, wow, what hit me? You know, this, I kind of had accustomed myself to thinking I was on a terminal course and now I'm not. So for the most part, I'd say two-thirds of the people I see, it's just been the best news ever. For others who came at a time when they were just getting that therapy and hadn't received other courses of therapy that were less effective or hadn't been clinically affected by the disease, even though their virologic and immunologic markers showed that they required therapy, they just responded well and are doing great, never developed opportunistic infections, never developed a diagnosis of AIDS, are continuing on with their life, taking medications, but just doing wonderfully well. For a smaller group of people, it's really not been a panacea. Their virus was resistant to every medication they tried, or they were just really unable to manage the difficult regimens that certainly for many years were required of people taking these multiple meds, and they did not fare as well. But for the most part, deaths have just declined tremendously in our clinic and throughout the country. There's a slight reversal of that, which we could talk about in a second, but certainly the mortality has gone down, people's lives are healthier, people are just doing much, much better. The other important part of that, of course, is that the medications have also produced a reduction in the transmission of the virus, particularly shown in the rates of perinatal transmission being so low right now. In the United States, in the entire United States, there probably weren't 250 children born with HIV last year. There are probably 6,000 or 7,000 women with HIV infection in the United States who were pregnant last year, and their transmission rate to their infants was basically was 2% or less. So the medications really have had a tremendous impact on the transmission of the virus and in the therapy of people with HIV.
Now, Marta, tell me about what it's like to deal with this treatment. I don't know that much about exactly what treatments you're getting, but can you just talk about when the ups and downs of your life with HIV and, you know, whether you can some days just pretend that it's not even there? Tell me about that.
Oh, yes. Well, I'm trying to think back. It's probably about 10 years now when I first started taking meds, and I don't know if I had mentioned this before, though, you know, with the meds, too bad that some of the things weren't there before, because I had also given birth to my son, who I passed it on to, I passed the virus on to, but we didn't know this until he was almost 8 years old, you know, because I got everybody tested when I went to get tested. Everybody in the house, boyfriend, daughter, son. And it came out that the boyfriend and my son were infected. So that I probably focused more on my son's health more than I did mine, even though I think I did a pretty good job of cleaning up, you know, my act and taking care of myself and him. Ups and downs. I've been in and out of different AIDS clinical trials, and that I did solely for the purpose of, well, somebody's got to do it so they could find out what's going on, you know, how these medications are working. I did the same thing with my son, and some of the things that he tried were not doing very well. The lab tests didn't come out very good. I've got probably a couple of bad experiences, only that the ignorance that other people had was very apparent. One day in fourth grade decided to reveal his intelligence as to answering a question the teacher gave if the class understood that viruses, you know, what viruses were, you know, you can't see them when you sneeze, you know, dirt on your hands, you know, how to be clean. And he revealed to the class, which I thought was not listening, that he had a virus that could cause AIDS. So that was a scary point there, because the school got involved with letting the community know that there was an infected child in the school, not to reveal his identity, but that was one thing that was scary.
What came of that?
He just realized then that he couldn't be as open as he was when we would be in clinic. You know, clinic was family. You know, clinic was something he could be himself with, playing around. He didn't feel sick, so he didn't know he was sick. You know, and not to say it sick in that way, but that he was carrying a virus. He's been careful since then to choosing who he's going to tell. He did reveal to a girlfriend he had a couple of years ago that he was HIV infected. And I mean, nothing has come of that, but still, he knows to be careful. I guess the other thing that I've had is changes in my body, the lipodystrophy. And I think that was the second most, you know, disturbing part of being HIV positive, the consequences of some of the medications. And since 10 years maybe, I said that I've been taking medications. Mm-hmm. This is the first time I'm taking a holiday, and it's been about 3 months now that I stopped. And we're just watching, because I've always had a good CD4 count and the percentage and, you know, the RNA, the viral load. It's always been pretty good. We're just watching it a little closer. And I've had some personal issues that have happened in my life. I lost my mom and stuff, so I kind of like, you know, I need a break from everything.
Now, Dr. Cohn, after highly active therapy was introduced in the mid-90s, fairly promptly the research was publishing improvements in survival, but it seemed that there was a lag for women in the improvements. Can you talk about that a bit?
Yeah, it took a few years for women to catch up to the same rates of decrease in mortality nationally and pretty much every place it's been studied. When examined very closely, it looks that women at the same stage of illness with the same sort of treatment probably do the same as men with HIV. It's just that we really haven't reached that kind of parity. In general, in most healthcare conditions, that parity doesn't exist between men and women. Cardiovascular disease, there's issues that women lag behind on available health services like angiograms and interventions for coronary artery disease. Same has been shown with lung cancer. So it's not exactly surprising we have a healthcare system that somehow does leave women behind many times. With HIV, though, we've also learned another issue, and that is that women with HIV, in many instances, the majority of women in our country who have HIV have led some pretty vulnerable lives. They've used drugs. They've been in abusive situations. They've come from a general impoverished environment, difficult lives. And these difficult lives put them at risk for other illnesses that might actually influence their mortality as well as HIV. So we've seen when we've looked at the exact causes of death for women with HIV that some women are not dying actually of HIV or AIDS itself, but rather are dying of non-HIV-related illnesses like drug overdoses, some violent situations, malignancies like lung cancer, those that are unrelated to malignancies that we see among HIV-infected persons. And we've seen some a very large number of liver deaths, probably related to a high prevalence of hepatitis C infection among women infected with HIV. The rate that we have in Chicago for hepatitis C co-infection in women with HIV is about 40%. So this kind of potential liver abnormality can also affect a woman's mortality and might influence her in terms of her health care. So we've seen that HIV deaths are coming down for women as well as men for the most part, but that there is a group of women, probably about one-fifth of the women with HIV who are dying, may be dying from causes that are really unrelated to HIV. So the understanding from this information, hopefully, is that we have to provide a kind of more comprehensive approach to care when women with HIV are in care so that we can address those problems as well. And just one other point. In 1999, some of the statistics nationally and I know locally in our city showed that there was a kind of blip in the mortality rate so that the mortality rates are either stabilizing, not continuing to go down, or in the instance of African-American women, have begun to go up again. Now, we don't have analyzed the data for 2000 yet, so we don't know if this is actually a trend or if this is something that will not be important, which I hope is true. But we are looking into that as well. So I think, as you know, though we didn't state it on this program, the majority of women in this country with HIV infection are either African-American or Latino women, so that women of color do bear the large burden of the infection in our country. Making sure that we understand all the factors that impact on someone's life when they're HIV infected is very, very important to understanding mortality in women with HIV.
Now, you're both undoubtedly acquainted with men who are infected with HIV. Speaking a bit about the emotional aspects of the disease or how it seems to affect people psychologically, do you think there's a difference between the genders, between how men and women react to having HIV infection?
My sense of the disease and therefore how it impacts the genders are more, there are percentage-wise many more women who fit into a category of having less of ability to gather the support, to have the funds to get therapy, whose lives are in many ways filled with the responsibility to take care of their families, their children, that these things weigh in as well as with a woman who has HIV. For some men who don't have those issues, they might be able to concentrate more on what their therapy needs are or just taking care of themselves better than someone who has so many other distractions. But my personal experience is that people cope with what they, you know, are given in some way and use the skills that they have as people to figure out ways to move on. And I've learned that from men and women definitely over the last decade and a half, taking care of people with HIV, and have been tremendously impressed with both genders about how people take themselves seriously, take their families seriously, and try to do the best they can to take care of themselves with this disease.
Well, I feel that, you know, I guess you've seen more of it than I have, Marge, where, you know, the woman has, when she has children to care mm-hmm. for, you know, that's just priority right there. And, mm-hmm. and when she's got two and three and four and five of them,
Right.
That puts a real damper on a lot of things.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think that those are kind of obstacles to concentrating just on your own care. And that's true all the time.
Mm-hmm.
That's part of why we started a clinic that had women and children seen at the same time, so that at least the taking of a child for a visit wouldn't be seen as an obstacle to the woman getting her own care, that it could happen simultaneously.
Today, we've been listening to an archive interview with Marge Cohen and Marta Santiago concerning the impact of the HIV epidemic on women in the U.S. After the break, we'll hear the second part of that interview. Then, later in the show, Marie Clark will present an opinion piece on the impact of international debt on the battle against HIV in the Global South. Stay tuned. This is Public Health Radio. Our guests today are Dr. Marge Cohen, Director of the Women and HIV Clinic at Cook County Hospital, and Marta Santiago, who is one of her patients and who's on the staff there. We're discussing life with HIV 20 years into the epidemic. Dr. Cohen, have the recommendations doctors make to HIV-infected patients about sexual transmission of the virus changed much over time?
Well, I think we've learned one very important fact, that in addition to safer sex protection to prevent the virus from being transmitted, that reduction in HIV viral load, the amount of virus that is measured in the plasma, is absolutely correlates with transmission. So that if one is lucky enough to have an undetectable viral load or a very low viral load, or is on therapy and their viral load is suppressed, that will definitely be the paramount factor which will prevent transmitting that virus to anybody else. That is some of the science behind perinatal transmission reduction, and it's been shown to be very, very important in both homosexual and heterosexual transmission. So we have learned that, and we didn't know that early on, but I think in terms of taking care of people and giving messages of encouraging full exploration of behaviors, but being as safe as possible and preventing further infection spread, the message is pretty much what they used to be. Have the safest behaviors and use protection.
Marta, how has HIV affected your romantic life, and how about your son?
Well, for me, what romantic life? I don't know if it's medications. I don't know if it's my age. I don't know if it's the difference. My eyes opening to just care for myself, caring more for myself. It's not an urge that I have there, and it's not something that I've pursued, nor have I answered calls from the wild to. As far as my son now, he's a young man, and he's in his prime, and all of us, you know, myself, his sister, his primary care team, have discussed extensively, you know, the importance of safe sex and caring for himself. So he needs condoms, they bring him condoms. But he's doing fine as far as his romantic life going. Myself, I'm happy the way I am right now. And that's without a partner.
I would want to add, if I could, that there are, this isn't exactly answering the question, but it's somewhat related. There is definitely an upsurge in the number of women who we're seeing at our clinic, and I've heard this at other clinics as well, who are seeking to consider becoming pregnant and having children now that the rates of perinatal transmission are so low and women are feeling so much better. The idea of having a family, which they had always wanted to have, seems like a much greater reality to them, and they are pursuing that.
Oh, and that I've certainly heard from my son. He's mentioned that every now and again. Well, when I have my family, you know, kind of thing. So he's got a positive look on that.
And how did HIV infection impact your thinking about having more children, Marta?
Me?
Yes.
Oh, no, I got fixed up years back. So I was like, you know, the factory was closed. My son was the last that I had. I only had two. And that was it. I mean, I had no desire to have any more children after I had my son, actually.
Dr. Cohn, what's your experience with that?
Earlier on, we saw many women who, if they did become pregnant, chose to have abortions. The rate of abortion is going down right now in our clinic. The number of women who are seeking to become pregnant in the safest way possible is going up. And I think it definitely attests the fact that women's lives feel much more normal and much more hopeful at this point in time. And that's kind of good.
Dr. Cohn, in an issue of the American Journal of Public Health last year, you published a research paper describing the unusually heavy impact of domestic violence on HIV-infected women. Tell our listeners about the findings.
Well, we found that in comparison in a study called the WISE Study, Women Interagency HIV Study, that started in 1994 and enrolled about 2,500 women across six sites in the United States, 2,000 infected women and 500 women at risk but not infected with HIV. We looked at the prevalence of domestic violence, including past history of sexual or physical abuse, and a current history, and we found that any history of abuse in both groups, the HIV negatives and the HIV positives, was very, very high. It was about 63-64%, and that was overwhelming to the researchers, but clearly was what the women had been experiencing. And the study, as we examined the factors that seemed to influence women who had, in the course of their experience with HIV, if they had this experience of violence, we learned that there really wasn't that much difference in number and prevalence between the HIV negative group and the HIV positive group, that women who did have a history of violence or child sexual abuse found themselves in kind of a cycle of abuse and high-risk behavior, that it was much more likely for women who'd had a history of childhood sexual abuse to find themselves in sexually abusive relationships, to be engaged in having sex for money or drugs, to be involved with partners who continue to abuse them and put them at risk for HIV. And we've learned that the impact of violence on a woman's ability to take her care seriously is also very, very important, because saying to someone, well, you know, I want to make sure that you understand what it means to have safer sexual relationships. Your partner, if you're talking to a woman, your partner should really be using a condom every time you have sex. And this woman is really unable to negotiate that kind of relationship, that kind of issue in her current relationship because of threats of violence. That would not be a meaningful exchange between a provider and a patient. You'd have to really understand what the woman's experience was with her partner in order to guide more seriously and really give messages that had some serious impact for this woman. So we realized that issues related to healthcare utilization, and kind of a sense of empowerment and a sense of good self-esteem and things that probably help adherence and good healthcare management in general need a lot more work in women who've had a very long history of abuse. And we see that it's extremely prominent in the women that we both take care of at the CORE Center and have been studying nationally.
Marta, any comments on that issue?
Dr. Cohen had me thinking of a couple of women, one in particular, who she just had nowhere to go when her boyfriend was very abusive once he found out that she was positive, and how he would verbally humiliate her on the corner, but she had nowhere to go. Mm-hmm. And so she had to take some of this. And what became of her, I don't know, but that was just coming to my mind. And it has a lot to do with self-esteem, you know, who you've mm-hmm. got as backup to support you when you need to get out of a relationship that is not healthy.
Mm-hmm.
So I know that a lot of the case managers and the mental health providers here have helped extremely some of these women who are in dire need of that.
Do you think that there's less stigmatizing of HIV-infected patients than there was 5 or 10 years ago?
I live in a world that is nothing but HIV, you know? So I don't know what it's like to be outside of this too much. It's from the house, you know, to the job and everything that any functions that I go to, they're, you know, fundraisers, HIV, you know, somehow, some kind of connection there. So it's like, I don't really know of anything but this, so I'm sure that there still is some, but I'm not the one to say that it's any better or any worse than it was.
I think we're still aware of patients who, when we say, and we ask this regularly, well, we'd like to have your phone number, we'd like to have an alternative number in case we can't reach you there. Does the person who will answer that phone know that you're HIV infected? And more than half the time, the person will say, oh, no, they don't, and I don't want you to tell them. So, I mean, rarely does someone who's calling for other medical diseases have to kind of protect that kind of confidentiality. So it still has a stigma associated with it. And I think the greatest good, in addition to providing serious concrete support for the worldwide real epidemic of people affected by this disease outside of the United States that people here can actually give to others, is the modeling of how we have overcome some of that stigma. Because we have. I mean, you know, we're better than we used to be, but we still have a long way to go. But the breaking of the silence, which in some ways did happen in this country, really has to happen in so many other countries for those people to be able to talk to others, acknowledge the disease, get treatment, and survive. And it's that important for the recognition of the disease, the recognition for how the disease is spread, the articulation of power relationships between men and women. All of that is essential to really stopping the spread of HIV infection worldwide, where it is so much higher prevalence than it is in our country right now. So I think we do have a lot to learn if we examine how we've kind of overcome some of the stigma, though not completely, and share that with others outside of the States.
For listeners who'd like to learn more about HIV and life with the virus, can you recommend some organizations or websites?
The site that I think a lot of providers and patients like to look at is called HIV Addis, A-T-I-S, www.hivaddis.org. It has all the recommendations, current recommendations, and a lot of good information. Also, World Health Organization and CDC have a lot of helpful information. HIV Addis can get you to all of that, actually.
Well, Christmas is upon us, a time of year when people commonly reflect on the past year and think about the upcoming year. I'd like to ask both of you, what are your hopes and your dreams for Christmas and for the next year upcoming?
For me, less bills, healthy life, happy life, and a job that I can keep coming to.
Sounds good. I think we have to deal with the global consequences of HIV and the global consequences of inequities that extend actually very similarly in the same places that HIV has reared its head across the globe. And that kind of world getting smaller and affecting all of us, as well as feeling that we have the potential to actually impact that globe, is something I hope all of us realize and try to do something about, because it's quite necessary in order to make an impact on this disease.
Well, I'd like to thank you both for joining us on Public Health Radio.
Thank you.
And I hope you'll join us again soon.
Okay.
Our opinion segment today will contrast the HIV epidemic in the U.S. with HIV as it is manifested in the countries of the Global South. We'll be hearing from Marie Clark, the National Coordinator of Jubilee USA, an international organization which is concerned with the impacts of the massive debt burden on public health in the less developed countries across the globe. Marie Clark, welcome to Public Health Radio.
Thanks, Marvin. On today's show, we have seen what HIV means to individuals in the U.S. who are living with the virus. Most patients are now taking complicated drug regimens, often fraught with side effects. The virus affects every aspect of patients' lives. Normally joyful life events, such as romantic involvement or starting a family, can take on a completely different meaning to patients who are living with HIV. Yet we have seen how dramatically patients' lives are improved over the last 10 years with the development of highly active antiretroviral drug treatment. And there is reason to feel cautiously optimistic that there can be further improvements in HIV care in the coming years. Unfortunately, the state of the HIV epidemic is very different in the countries of the Global South. For the millions of HIV-infected people in these countries, the breathtaking advances in HIV virology and HIV treatment might just as well not have occurred. For to them, it might as well still be 1982, when we had no understanding of the disease at all. This is not because of the ignorance in the Global South, but because of a lack of access to treatment. Imagine towns and villages where all you could see are grandparents and young children, and the rest are mysteriously missing. The schools have no teachers. The hospitals have no nurses. This is what AIDS is creating in impoverished countries. Every day, 8,000 people die from AIDS. Without drastic action, 40 million children will be orphaned from the AIDS epidemic by the year 2010. This is the same number of children who started public school this year east of the Mississippi. Imagine if all of those children's parents were suddenly missing. Of all the regions in the world, sub-Saharan Africa has been hit the hardest by AIDS. This region includes 1/10 of the world's population, yet it accounts for 70% of persons who are currently affected. Of all the regions in the world, sub-Saharan Africa has been hit the hardest by AIDS. This region includes 1/10 of the world's population, yet it accounts for 70% of persons who are currently infected. Most of those infected are women, and the majority contracted the disease before they reached adulthood. Some 20 million Africans, 1/4 of them children, have already died as a result of AIDS, and millions more will die each and every year. Not since the Black Plague during the Middle Ages has there been so large a threat to millions of people and the future of entire economies. But people all over the world are fighting back. They are working to save their families and their towns. Where funding has been available, a number of countries in the Global South have been winning battles in the struggle to stop AIDS. But the heavily affected poor countries cannot be expected to raise the needed funds on their own by raising taxes. In most of the affected countries, the average per capita annual income is less than $400 per year. The wealthy countries across the world have begun to provide desperately needed aid, but thus far, the aid has been far too meager. In the United States, opinion polls show that most Americans believe that our government provides massive amounts of development aid to poor countries of the world. The reality is very different. Each year, U.S. aid donations are very modest. In most years, our aid amounts to less than 0.1% of our GDP. As a percent of GDP, we donate less for development aid than virtually all other industrialized countries. Health and development officials have estimated that a minimum amount of money needed to fight AIDS and other diseases such as tuberculosis and malaria is $10 to $15 billion every year. But sub-Saharan Africa alone pays almost $15 billion annually in debt service. The implications are clear. Much of this debt was accumulated decades ago by unpopular regimes. Yet years later, the citizens of these countries are burdened by the consequences. Those of us in the wealthy countries have little cause to think about the World Bank and the IMF, the International Monetary Fund. Yet to debt-ridden countries, failure to cooperate with the World Bank and the IMF would scare away most potential new investment. So most of the poor countries of the world are at the mercy of these two organizations, which are controlled by the bankers and the other elite of wealthy countries. To foster debt repayment, payment back to the banks, the IMF requires a series of policies called structural adjustment. Virtually every one of these policies worsens poverty and ill health. First, the governments are compelled to sell off government-owned assets, including clinics and other health facilities. One of the more recent IMF initiatives has even required governments in several countries to sell off their water supply. When health clinics are sold to private owners, those who run the facility may no longer be willing or financially able to provide care for the poor. Another structural adjustment policy is currency devaluation. This may attract investment, but it also lessens the ability of health facilities in the country to purchase medical supplies and equipment abroad. Another structural adjustment policy is to provide fewer services and charging user fees even for the basic government services such as basic health care and basic education. Many governments have been forced to cut the number of clinics they support and often must charge user fees for the ones that continue to operate. Many people cannot afford these fees, so they simply do not go to the clinic when they need medical care. This has severe repercussions for the AIDS crisis. To give just one example, people suffering from sexually transmitted diseases have an increased risk of HIV infection. Yet many of these sexually transmitted diseases are easily treatable, and the number of afflicted persons contracting the HIV virus could be cut by about 40%, with treatment costing as little as $2 per person. A few years ago, Kenya followed a recommendation of the World Bank to institute a user fee of $2.15 to visit STD clinics. Attendance fell quickly by nearly 50%, putting an increased number of people at risk. Poor nutrition and illiteracy both contribute to increased risk of HIV. When structural adjustment programs are implemented, government support for basic food items are often eliminated, and patients are required to pay an unaffordable user fee for their child to attend public school. Having implemented structural adjustment regimes, many countries in Africa and other parts of the Global South are succeeding in at least making interest payments on their debt, and a few are actually beginning to pay down their debt. But this diversion of resources towards debt repayment undermines the fight against AIDS and other threats to public health. More than half of African nations spend more on debt payments than on health care. Every dollar spent on servicing the debt is a dollar not spent on HIV treatment and prevention. Advocates for Development have begun a sustained worldwide campaign to persuade the wealthy nations to simply forgive these unsustainable and harmful debt burdens. There has been some progress in achieving this. Some countries have been granted a degree of debt relief, and this has allowed them to devote more resources to the fight against AIDS. For example, Malawi received a cut in debt service of 30%, or $28 million. These funds finance the purchase of critical drugs for hospitals and health centers, hiring extra staff, and support of primary health centers and training new nurses. Uganda has also made progress, nearly tripling their spending on primary health care as a result of debt relief. Cameroon has put its $114 million cut in debt service to good use. With an HIV rate that by the end of 1999 was approaching 8%, Cameroon chose to spend some of that savings to fund voluntary HIV testing and counseling, the promotion of behavior change, and preventing HIV transmission from pregnant women to their babies. The AIDS crisis in Africa and many other parts of the world is unparalleled in its devastating effects on lives and communities. Destabilization abroad due to the HIV crisis is at least as bad for our national security as any existing military threat. Canceling the debt and providing a truly generous amount of aid to support the struggling health sectors in these countries would be a dramatic gesture and would do more for our national security than our far more costly military buildup. Abroad, U.S. policies are almost universally viewed as being selfish. Our government appears to be willing to spend billions of dollars to support virtually any military scheme the defense planners devise. Diverting a small fraction of this money to aid and to debt forgiveness would begin the process of restoring a more positive view of the U.S. We would then be able to demonstrate in a palpable way that we care enough about the devastation of the world's poorest countries to take a meaningful step. We will not sit idly by ignoring the greatest public health threat that the world has seen in several centuries. So please visit our website for more information, www.jubileeusa.org. As Christmas draws near, many of us come to appreciate the many blessings those of us in the U.S. enjoy. One of those gifts is the ability to reach out to others who are less fortunate. We may never hear the voice of an HIV-infected woman from the poorer reaches of the globe as we have heard the stories of HIV-infected women in the U.S. on this show today. But they are nonetheless every bit as connected to us, and they are depending on us. So become a part of the solution. Once again, visit our website at www.jubileeusa.org. Learn more. Get involved. May you all have a peaceful holiday season.
Well, that's it for today's show. Join us again next month for another airing of Public Health Radio. And I'd like to wish all our listeners a wonderful Christmas holiday and a happy new year.